You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Future Projection Podcast. This is episode 18. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined as always by Ben Badler. Ben, what's going on, man?
I'm doing great, Carlos. Just been digging into a lot of very lower level minor league prospects. So we're kicking up our league top prospects list and putting together the prospect handbook. So doing a lot of that and getting ready to travel too. So it's busy but fun.
Yeah, it seems like Ben has been on the phone basically the entire day, and here we are recording Monday night and about to record a podcast for all of you. So really kudos to you, Ben, for pushing through. Hopefully your voice holds up throughout this podcast. I feel like we got into a little bit of a groove of recording in the early afternoon, but our first few were at night, so we shouldn't have any issues with it. But yeah, same with me. Got the Baseball Factory All-Star Game this weekend that I'm excited to get to. And then Jupiter a few weeks after that. But outside of those two events and some updates to our current draft list, it's basically just a lot of focusing on minor leagues. I need to start diving into the Braves and the Twins handbook chapters at some point. We've got really the playoff races are starting to kind of culminate at the major league level. Minor league regular season has been wrapped today as we record this. I think AAA has like a kind of a unique postseason tournament that they're doing. Is that what it is?
Yeah, AAA still going on, and everybody else is
so they're still playing regular season games.
Yeah, like AAA is still going to be playing. Some teams are starting up their instructional league now. You know, it's weird this year because some teams are doing instructional league. Some teams are not. Obviously, like last year, was instructional league was super important. Maybe the Cardinals and Yankees disagree because they didn't have one. But, you know, you didn't have any minor league season. And if you didn't have your guys at the alternate training site, these guys are just working out on their own. So it was your only opportunity to bring, especially the lower level players, and you know, and your new draft picks in to sign this year. It's more of a normal season. It's not super important, I think, to have guys in and be playing more games after you just played all season long. So some teams will have, you know, check-in camps at mm-hmm. different points throughout the year, strength camp, like velocity camp, basically, and in some teams have or different groups that they'll bring in over the winter, things like that. And there'll be, I think, some teams are playing each other in games. Other teams are just saying either no games or intra-squad games for COVID reasons. So it's a weird, you know, AAA is going on, but also we're playing instructional league. So kind of an unusual feel to it.
Well, just tacking on to everything else that's been unusual about this year in the past couple of years, really. Yeah, but on top of that, we've got MLB playoffs coming up. Lots of other sports are kicking off on college campuses. Fall baseball practices are underway. Arizona Fall League. So I feel like there's a lot going on. I feel like late September and October really is probably the best time of the year for just sports in general. I know normally we're focused exclusively on baseball, but it does seem like there's just a lot going on at this time of year. I always really like this time of year. I guess before we get into some of our other topics, do you have like a personal favorite time of year for sports or for baseball? I guess outside of this period for me, playoff baseball is always so fun to watch. I really enjoy the first few weeks of the college season because that is like everyone is pining for baseball at that point. Everyone's getting ready for Major League opening day, which typically happens about a month after the college season gets rolling. So the opening weekend of college baseball is really good. And then obviously I love the draft. So those two are kind of the highlights for me. in addition to playoff baseball? Are there any periods or specific time pegs you have of the season that, that you really get excited about, or the year?
The only sport I just care about or follow anymore is baseball. I mean, growing up, I used to love basketball, football, NFL, college football, college basketball, NBA. But now it's just, there's just so much baseball year round for me that I want to know more about, so many players I want to know about, so many games I want to watch. I'm just so all in on baseball. So to me, the best is just October. I mean, there's nothing better than playoff baseball. I can't wait to just when the playoffs start and I can just sit. I mean, I'll actually probably be on the road then, but otherwise just be to just sit in a room and just watch baseball from the time playoff baseball from the time it comes on at noon or one or whatever time it starts on the East Coast and go until after midnight for games with the best teams in the game and just a great atmosphere and games that matter. That's to me is just the best.
So you bring up a good point about travel. I feel like every year, I guess last year was an exception for me, every year when like the exciting early round playoff baseball is happening, I feel like I'm in Jupiter and that's like a week long tournament. So I'm kind of aware of what's happening, but I'm never really watching the games early on. And then I have to catch up kind of in the second half of the postseason. Do you, I guess for your schedule, typically, is it you kind of in handbook mode so you can just have the games on while you're working on handbook chapters, or what is that like for you? Because I know JJ, if he was on, I'm sure he'd talk about how he has a million screens set up, but I always found it very difficult to focus while having a game on, especially if there's volume. But if the games are just on and I can kind of glance and see the score and then check in, maybe if there's an intense situation going on, that works for me. But it's very tough for me, especially if I'm writing, to have a lot of stuff going on at the same time. So what's your kind of work balance there?
Yeah, I can't do that 3 or 4 screen thing. My brain is just not wired that way. Even when, like, you know, even at a tournament like Jupiter or some similar tournament where there's 4 games going on at once, I got to pick one game, focus on this. Maybe if there's, you know, a game going on in an adjacent field with some priority players, I'll keep an eye out for, all right, Max Clark is coming up. I know where he is in the order. I know where to watch for him. I'll make sure I see him when his bets are happening. But yeah, for me, it's just a gluttonous day of baseball, of watching baseball, scheduling calls where I'll, you know, be on the phone with scouts or folks in player development, whoever else, and writing about it too like you said, usually for the handbook at that time of the year.
Yeah, no doubt. So it's definitely a fun time of year. We can go ahead and dive into some of the topics we have to talk about. I wanted to bring up the Royals 2018 draft class really quickly, just because a few days ago, Randy Cicerelli tweeted that when John Heasley takes the mound tonight in his major league debut, this was September 17th, he tweeted this, the 2018 Royals draft will be the first in major league history to produce 5 pitchers who all made a start for the team that drafted them in the same season. In addition to John Heasley, it was Brady Singer, Jackson Coar, Daniel Lynch, Chris Bubich. And I feel like we probably could just look back and talk about how impressive this class is, or at least how aggressive the Royals were in getting some of these college arms into the system, and how that's panned out for them and what you think about those arms right now. But it is pretty impressive that all of those arms have gotten to the major league level. Each of those pitchers were their first 5, I believe. Jonathan Bolin was their 5th. Heasley was actually in after the 10th round pick. He was the 13th round selection. They signed him for $247,000. All the other guys were top 4 round picks, or excuse me, their top 4 picks. They were all first round selections, with Chris Bubich being in the supplemental first. So I guess that does make it a little, not less impressive, but when you do have the 18th pick of a draft, the 33rd pick of a draft, the 34th pick of the draft, and the 40th, you kind of have higher expectations for that draft class. But I do feel like it's pretty impressive to hit on that many players, especially when you're talking about the pitching demographic. There are a number of things we could get into with this draft class, between Singer and Coar being rotation mates at Florida, the fact that Singer was even available at 18. But just what are your thoughts on that kind of collection of talent as we sit here in 2021 with the benefit of hindsight?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you're taking a college pitcher, I mean, part of the reason they were able to do it is just because they took college pitchers with their top four picks, right? So if you're taking a college pitcher in the top 40 picks in the draft, they should get to the big leagues. They don't always, that doesn't always happen. So, but that, I think that's part of a big part of that stat is just that they used those. They had a lot of extra picks in the draft that year. They had, you know, 18, 33, 34, 40, you know, 58 also in the, with their second round pick. And they used them all on college pitchers. So I think that skews it. I mean, John Heasley, obviously getting there as a 13th round pick is, you know, a different story. But, you know, that said, look, you know, all those guys that they took for the most part are look like pretty good arms. So yeah, it is impressive. The, collection of talent that they have that, you know, regardless of whether they got to the big leagues, just how they project going forward, because a lot of times we do see teams that have a whole bunch of extra picks. And sometimes you think, wow, like this team is just going to absolutely crush the draft. They have so many extra picks, but it doesn't typically end up working out that way. But in this case, yeah, they got a lot of big league arms out of that draft.
And what's also kind of interesting about that draft specifically is I think at the time the Royals still had a high school flavor to them. It seemed like they were one of the teams that were very aggressive in high school prospects. So at the time, I remember it almost seemed like a bit of a, maybe not a turning point for them philosophically, but at least interesting that they went so college heavy. I think their first, all their picks in the top eight rounds were college. Then they took their first high school player, outfielder Kevin Jackson in the ninth round, then back to more college after that. So that was interesting at the time, but what are your thoughts? I think at the time, Dayton Moore mentioned something about taking college players to kind of match with the wave of young high school bats that they had taken previously. In the 2017 draft, they took Nick Prado in the first round and then MJ Melendez in the second. And I think there definitely was some internal thinking of pairing a wave of college players with a wave of younger high school players who have already been in your system. Do you think that's a smart strategy in general? Do you think teams maybe overestimate their ability to kind of match waves of players together? Or do you think that's probably just a smart strategy to go with? Because I've always found that interesting, just the idea of, okay, last year we were really high school heavy. These were maybe the demographics that we either took advantage of or have panned out for us. How can we use this next year's draft class to maybe pair more talent with them so you can kind of create a wave of talent through your farm system? Do you think that matters at all, or do you think that's trying to get too cute with things?
I think it's probably pretty difficult to time that, and to if you're going away from who the best player is or some combination of how to maximize your draft pool to get the, you know, best combination of players into your organization, then I think that would be a mistake. I don't know that's necessarily what the Royals did in this case, but it just as far as trying to time it, like you said, oh, we're going to draft more college players because we think this is where this is better for us, where we are in our farm system is at right now, and when they can matriculate up to the big leagues. I think it just makes more sense to go for the best players and just try to inject the most amount of talent into the system as possible rather than worrying about trying to time it. I mean, you can time your major league window if you want and make a bigger splash in free agency or use your prospects in trades to acquire big leaguers who can help your team when you're ready to contend. But as far as drafting players, college versus high school, based on where you know, the where the most talent is in your farm system right now, that's not really something that has a whole lot of appeal to me.
Yeah, definitely. Well, either way, whether they did this intentionally or not, they do rank near the top of our org talent rankings at this point. Their collection of college arms are at the top of that group with some new additions like Asa Lacy, MJ Melendez, and Nick Prado have both had really impressive bounce back seasons this year after down 2019 seasons. And then obviously Bobby Witt Jr. has developed into one of the better prospects in baseball. So they are sitting in a pretty good spot with a good blend of hitters and pitchers, and probably some position players and pitchers further down in the rankings who probably deserve some attention. I know Matt Eddy is a big Vinny Pasquantino guy. Some other names in there that are interesting to me, like Peyton Wilson, Nick Lofton, some college middle infielders that are intriguing, and even lesser pitching prospects like Austin Cox, who I still really like. So they have an impressive collection of talent. And I imagine they're only going to be more interesting at the major league level in the next few years. I can't imagine that a guy like Bobby Witt Jr. won't be doing exciting things at the major league level very shortly.
Let's go with Salvador Perez, who going to hit like 50 home runs this year, man. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Very timely segue there. I think tonight as we record this, he hit his 46th home run of the season, which broke, whose record did he break?
Johnny Bench.
It's like the most home runs by a primary catcher since Johnny Bench, which is insane. Like, part of me is a little surprised that record hasn't already been broken, because I do feel like we've had a number of really impressive catchers since then, obviously. Like, it's a little surprising that a guy like Mike Piazza never broke that record. I need to actually look into it and see what the specifics are or when Johnny Bench... What was the most that Mike Piazza hit in a season? Do you know off the top of your head?
He might have had... Did he ever have more than that? I wonder if it's just... I don't know. I didn't see the details of how they were categorizing like a primary catcher. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think Piazza topped out at 40 home runs.
He had a couple 40 home run seasons. In 1999, he hit 40. And in 1997, he hit 40. And though that was tied for his career high, a number of 30 plus home run seasons. But yeah, Johnny Bench in 1970, 45 home runs, led the league in RBIs, led the league in sac flies that year. And now Salvador Perez, who honestly feels a little underrated at this point. You think so or no? Maybe I'm just not giving him the credit that he deserves, but.
Well, he just was like, you know, he didn't play in 2019. Mm-hmm. And he's always been, I think, pretty highly regarded, obviously, for his defense, but mm-hmm. he's always been a pretty low on base guy. But I mean, you don't typically think of a catcher getting into his 30s and then now he's going to get better. No, you think he's going to get, you know, the wear and tear on his body, and that's when they start to break down, and he's such a big dude. Like, how long is he gonna last back there? And he just keeps getting better into his early 30s, which you just would not think that would happen, but it's awesome to see him developing that way. And like, you think back too to when he was, I mean, back when he was a prospect, they had him and they had Will Myers at catcher, and it was like, well, obviously Perez is a better defensive catcher, but I think pretty widely held thought around baseball, including that I had, was that Will Myers was going to end up being the better player, even if he moved off catcher, just because his bat was so much more advanced. Myers was a better hitter. He had more power than Salvador Perez. He had a better approach. And I mean, we're looking at it now, I mean, 10 plus years later, and I think it's pretty clear Salvador Perez is having the better career.
Yeah, it is insane. It's your point about players getting better after their age 30 season, just into their 30s. his, just going off Ops Plus, it's the best season he's had since his rookie year, which was a 39 game season in 2011, where he had a 128 Ops Plus. This year it's 126. And if you count the shortened 2020 season, that's easily the best year of his career, 160 Ops Plus, but again, just 37 games. So if you look at just full seasons, this is his best offensive year pretty easily if you're just looking at Ops Plus.
You're an Ops Plus guy?
I think I like it. I like that in WRC Plus as just like, let's look at the numbers.
I mean more on a pronunciation level. I would go OPS Plus.
I've gone back and forth on this the other day. I asked, there was one stat. Yeah, I think it might have even been WRC Plus. So I always say WRC Plus. And I don't know if I used to say OPS Plus or Ops Plus, but I asked how someone said WRC Plus, and I heard that there are people that say work plus, and I had never heard.
How else would you pronounce WRC plus?
Yeah, no, I've heard that some people with teams say work plus, and I hate
work
it.
Work plus.
So now I'm feeling really weird about saying Ops Plus, because as awkward as work plus sounds to me is probably how awkward Ops Plus was sounding to you, and I'm very self-conscious about having said that now.
Ops at least is, I can see, like, you're
at least
trying
sounds
to
a little
pronounce,
bit cooler.
You're trying to pronounce the acronym.
Yeah.
I can get that. Like, I mean, like, you know, I wouldn't, you don't want to call it WAR.
CSA war.
Yeah. All right. You call it war.
Yeah. I think if it like phonetically, if it makes sense to say it as a word, I probably tend to do that. Like UZR, I would never say like, I would never try to make that a word. I'm trying to think of some other common.
I think I
ones.
Used to call it oozer. Now I just don't use it because
there's no way. There's no way you said that.
Oozer, yeah, like
you
like
actually
oozer.
Said that. Okay, so I don't see how you can make fun of me for saying Ops Plus if you said oozer. But man, I'm looking at Salvador Perez's WAR from 2011 to 2021, just to see kind of where he ranks. Where would you guess? So this is, I'm just pulling up Fangraphs from 2011 to 2021, qualified catchers sorted by Fangraphs WAR. Where would you think he ranks?
Probably right behind Buster Posey. I mean, it coincides right with, you know, basically his entire 20s. So
yeah, he's 14th. Unless I'm doing something wrong. I was very surprised. And now I want to see where Baseball Reference has him. Because I know the way they calculate, especially catcher wins above replacement, is pretty significant. But Salvador Perez is at 14.9. They must really not like his. I mean, they like his defense okay. I don't understand this one at all. Doesn't that seem a bit wild to you?
Yeah, that does seem a little light.
I'm going to his player page now to see where. Yeah, Fangraphs has never had Salvador Perez as being worth more than 3.5 wins above replacement in a single season, which does seem a bit light. But like you said, he's always been a lower OBP guy. And if for whatever reason their metrics don't like his defense, I guess that could explain it. But the gap seems a little bit insane. So
you say OBP, not ABAPA?
There's no other way to say OBP. And for reference, I pulled up the Baseball Reference page. BREF has Salvador worth 29.3 wins above replacement, which is basically double what Fangraphs has him as. So I do think this is one of the examples where you can't just kind of point to WAR, whichever WAR you choose, and kind of have it be the end-all be-all. There's a lot of nuance and different arguments you can get from various advanced statistics and how you use them and how you unpack them. So. Either way, a little surprised to see him that low. Any other stats you want to throw out there, Ben, to see how we pronounce them, make sure we're on the same page? Or do you think our listeners are probably being driven crazy by us saying all these? I think this is also an interesting point to make, because I never really think about how I say them, because I just find myself, I mean, I write about all of these so much more often, and you don't really have to think about how you say them. But this is a good lesson learned here.
How do you pronounce the acronym for weighted on base average?
I probably say WOBA in my head.
WOBA. Yeah.
I don't say WOBA at all.
Or not.
Yeah, so
WOBA.
I think it's just, for me, it's probably like, if it naturally seems like it could be a word, not a word, but like you could just say it out loud without making like saying the acronym letter for letter, I'd probably default to that.
Yeah. I think
a good combination of letters, I'm good to say it as a word.
I still can't get, I can't say ops plus. I got
to
go.
All right. OPS. We'll have to take a poll, see what our listeners think, see who's GIF, right, who's wrong.
GIF or GIF, that kind of.
Oh, are you a GIF guy or are you a GIF guy?
I always called it GIF. And then everybody says that's wrong.
We can't do this. We can't do this. I think the person who made GIFs says it's GIF. So I think there is something to you people who are on the wrong side of history now. You have a pretty good argument, but I think most people probably say GIF at this point. I just think GIF sounds weird.
Just the guy who coined the term says you're wrong.
What does he know? What does he know? I wanted to also bring up the I feel like it's a bigger story that maybe has been a little bit overshadowed. Maybe not. Maybe I'm not doing credit to the amount of attention that's been given this. But Brittany Giroli with The Athletic had a story on the Phillies and Mets minor leaguers protesting pay and wearing #FairBall wristbands this weekend. It was during Saturday's game. And basically, the attempt was just to bring awareness to minor league pay. There was a statement issued from players from both teams that said, minor league baseball players have been severely underpaid and silenced for decades. Today, we're wearing #FairBall wristbands to show our solidarity with every fan and ally who is working to change that. We love the game of baseball, but it needs to evolve. It is time for every minor leaguer to be paid a living wage. I feel like this has kind of been building for a while now. I know JJ's written a bunch of stories about just the living conditions that minor league players have to go through. And it's an open secret that minor league players haven't been paid probably what they're worth for a long time now. It seems like something's got to change in the future. I feel like there have been steps that teams have taken to make very incremental benefits to minor league players. But what is your general thought on this protest? Do you think anything's going to change in the near future? And I guess what kind of system should major league teams want for their minor league players? I mean, all of these, I would imagine you want all of these guys to be in the best environments possible to develop. I've never really understood why these teams that are so profitable with uber wealthy owners have really cut corners with food for players, housing for players, pay for players. But yeah, what are your thoughts on this, Ben?
Yeah, I don't want to hear another team talk about their performance science department when you have your players sleeping three to a room on an air mattress in an apartment that they can barely afford for some of them. It's embarrassing. It's what teams have been paying minor league players for years for their salaries has been atrocious. I think the only changes you're going to see are probably at least in the next few years, I would imagine, would probably be smaller incremental things, something where MLB will go from, you know, the owners will go from paying their players an A-ball, you know, $8,000 a year to $10,000 a year or something like that. And then they will talk about how they're giving everybody a 25% increase in pay or something like that.
Yeah.
And trumpet how great they are about that. Or you'll see some more teams possibly doing that on their own. I think they would get a lot of pushback from the commissioner's office unless it was something extremely, you know, small in the grand scheme of things, but they were doing it to, you know, oh, we increased these guys pay 50%. Well, okay. Well, if they go from making $8,000 a year to $12,000 a year, it's like, I don't think you deserve a pat on the back for it. So again, this is just another example too, of what we've talked about before, where players who are not on the 40-man roster have pretty much no power in baseball. It's true for draft picks. It's true for international amateur players, and it's true for minor league players who are not on the 40-man roster, are not represented by the union. The union is not looking out for players who are are in the minor leagues who are not on 40-man rosters, and team, the owners, yeah, they're, you know, very, you know, they own an asset in the club that is extremely valuable. And the reason they don't want to pay more money is to the players is, yeah, it'll cost them, you know, maybe a few million, which seems like small change, but they don't want to spend the extra few million dollars that it would take to, you know, just increase these guys' pay to make sure everybody's making, you know, what, 25, 30 grand a year, something that's not, I mean, still on the lower end of pay for somebody who you're, you know, expecting to really do year round work.
Yeah. That's the thing is they're only paid for the, for in season months, which is basically like 5 months out of the year. And then they're expected to handle their training and development over the off season. But for most minor leaguers, you have to get a job in the off season to make rent, save up money. I mean, no one is making, I shouldn't say no one, but most minor league players are not making money during the season. They're barely making enough to meet ends meet as they are rooming with four, five, six other people in season. I think it was good piece of context that Brittany had in her story. If you look at the NBA G League and the AHL, which is the developmental league for the NHL, players in the G League have a minimum salary of $35,000 and housing is covered. And in the AHL, for this season, the minimum was $51,000, which is far and away better than what minor league players get. And I think it's notable that NBA G League players created a union last year. I would imagine, I don't know what the history of NBA G League player salary is, how much higher that $35,000 mark was prior to the union. But again, the AHL players are part of a union as well. And I imagine unionizing for the minor league players, whether that's a separate union from the MLBPA or the MLBPA starting to rep these players. I guess if they're repping minor league players, you'd have to change the name at that point. But it does seem like if you have a union, you're going to have a much easier time getting paid what you deserve to be paid, or at least paid what you cannot stress about what you're going to do next week for rent or what you're going to do in the offseason.
This is not, doesn't have any, like, look, nobody's crying for like Adley Rutschman or Bobby Witt Jr.
For sure.
Who were top, you know, first round pick signed for millions of dollars. And those are the guys who most people know about and you hear their names on day one of the draft. But the reality is, man, I forget the, I don't quote the exact percentage. At one point it was at least 25% of players, I think both in the draft internationally, who were getting like 10 grand or below, and a significant number of, even more than that, were signing for $50,000 or below. And all right, well, that sounds all right. Like $10,000 to start is good money, I guess. Mm. But like, not if you're going to go out and you're going to spend your first 3 years playing rookie ball, making like $3,000 for the entire year, maybe even less if you're in the, certainly less if you're in the Dominican Summer League. So you're going to stretch $10,000 signing bonus over what, 5 years? I mean, the numbers just don't add up. How are you going to make that work? I mean, hopefully
peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and ramen is a lot in the future.
It's absurd to not pay these guys, you know, basic wage that doesn't have them living under the poverty level when you're trying to develop these players into big leaguers. And those $10,000 guys that you're signing from Latin America, or those $1,000, $2,000, whatever it is, senior signs, turn into legitimate prospects for you, especially out of Latin America, when you're signing guys for, you know, at 16, 17 years old and a lot of pitching that you can get, who are good, who end up being good prospects pretty quickly sometimes for 10 grand or 70 grand, to not give these guys a real salary is just embarrassing for these clubs.
And just think about all the players that had to step away from minor league baseball for strictly financial reasons that could have easily developed into solid or better major league players, but they couldn't afford to keep doing it. They had obligations outside of the sport they needed to handle. And so they didn't have a leash long enough to really see what they could turn into as a prospect or as a complementary player or whatever the reason. But I'm sure there are hundreds and hundreds of players that have had to step away from the game because they're not supported enough financially to make it work. If you've got a family and they're relying on you to bring money home, I don't understand how that works. I mean, it doesn't in many cases. So
I can't imagine who would not be on the player's side here, unless maybe you work in the commissioner's office or you are one of the people who owns one of these 30 teams and you're listening.
Yeah. I don't think anyone's going to be arguing with us too much on that for the vast majority of listeners here. But hopefully something will change in the future. Again, this offseason, I'm sure there are going to be a ton of changes with the CBA and negotiations between the union and between the league. I'm not optimistic because I feel like there's really no reason for me to be optimistic at this point, but hopefully with more protests and more action from the players themselves, kind of drawing attention to this, something will change for the better in the future. But maybe in a less depressing bit of news from The Athletic, Jason Stark had a piece, I believe it was this weekend as well, kind of talking about the minor league pitch clock and wondering if that can take the game time down, help our pace of play for baseball at the major league level. He just cited Low A West using a pitch clock this year. And basically before the pitch clock, game time was 3 hours and 2 minutes. After the pitch clock, it went down to 2 hours and 41 minutes. You guys should definitely go check out the full article. But you should also check out JJ Cooper's article that he wrote kind of in response to this, just detailing how the benefits of the pitch clock have come into minor league baseball and then seemingly very quickly dissipated or gone back to previous times or even longer than previous game times in most cases, I think. But basically, I just wanted to throw it out to you, Ben, and see what you thought of the pitch clock at the minor league level. If you think this is a real way to help the pace of the game, I'm not necessarily too concerned over the pitch clock shortening game time, but I do think if it can create a better pace and kill some dead time, I'm all for it. And just in my personal experience watching minor league games with the pitch clock, and I think most people that I've heard who have experienced it kind of tell you that you forget about it very quickly and you don't really notice it. I'm kind of in that same boat. I forget about the pitch clock pretty quickly after I get to a minor league game and it doesn't really bother me too much. But I'm just curious what you think about pitch clocks in general, if you think it's a real solution to just creating more pace in the game and maybe even some secondary benefits or maybe negatives, depending on how you feel about the game, of increasing offense, more hits, more runs, higher ERAs.
Yeah, I think people generally who have been to a game where there is a pitch clock will come away saying, yeah, I didn't even notice it was there beyond the novelty of seeing it at first. But after about an inning or two, it just fades into the background. You don't really notice it. And it, as long as it's enforced, it does speed up it does improve the flow of the game, which is important. I don't think the time of the game is so important. Like it's not about, let's get home 19 minutes earlier. That's not the point. It's like you said, you're just cleaning up dead time. It's not that you're getting, if the game goes 3 hours and 20 minutes instead of 3 hours, you're not getting more baseball with 3 hour and 20 minute game. You're just getting more dead time. If it's the same, you know, all else being equal. So yeah, at first when they first came up with the idea of pitch clocks, I thought this is dumb. I'm not a fan of this. When you go to the game and you see it in person, it just fades into the background. It's not a distraction. You don't notice it, except again, as long as it's enforced, the game does move along with better flow to it. So I'd be in favor of seeing it at the big league level.
Yeah, players are definitely not going to like that. No player, especially no pitcher is going to want to speed up any more than he has to. Every player involved is going to want to take as much time as they very well please, and they've done it their whole career, so that makes sense. But as more players get into the major league game who have been exposed to the pitch clock in whatever capacity, whether that's as a pitcher or as a hitter, I feel like they'll at least be more open to that. I would hope so. And I honestly really don't care to have pitchers kind of rest up 30 seconds in between every pitch and throw full effort. Like, it's fine with me if pitchers can't get every little bit of energy into every little pitch, because I think the game will wind up being more fun. And it's also, it's not an issue where any one player is being affected in a negative way. It's kind of an across the board, everyone's dealing with the same situation. So yeah, while pitcher ERAs might go up, while offense in general might go up, I mean, the best pitchers should still be the best pitchers in this situation.
That's the thing is it doesn't affect most pitchers. It just takes the biggest slowpokes who are just dragging along and causing the game to just crawl to this just slower pace and just drag everything out. It takes them and says, all right, you guys got to pick it up a little bit here. For most pitchers, it's not going to have an impact. It's just those really slow guys, you know, those guys who come in out of the bullpen for the most part, and like you said, want to throw 100% max effort on every pitch and breathe and take all this time in between pitches. Like, yeah. Oh, you gotta pick it up, buddy.
No breathing here. Hold your breath. Get on the mound and throw. One other thing that it's not directly related to this, but I've had this thought the last few games that I've been to, and I don't know if it's just where pro ball you get more time, but I really don't understand why pitchers who are coming in from the bullpen get as many warm-up pitches as they do on the game mound. What is the point of the bullpen if you're going to come in and throw 12 pitches off the game mound? The whole point of the bullpen is so you can get warmed up before you come in. I think you should come in, get two pitches, get your feel on the game mound, and go. Why are we warming up twice?
Well, then Budweiser and Roman and whoever else can't advertise in as much.
I guess. Can we have just pop-up in-game advertisements? I'd much prefer that than 4 minutes in between innings for ads and an ad break going to the bullpen. Like, we don't need this much time to get ready. That's what the bullpen is for. That's my hot take of the day.
I'd be all for it.
Yeah. Okay. Glad we're of one mind for that one. Last kind of newsy item that I wanted to bring up and just see what you thought, Ben, is this story from yahoo.com about Freddie Freeman. It's by Hannah Kaiser, and she basically wrote about Freddie Freeman's no games off mentality. I think most people are probably pretty aware of Freeman's reputation as a guy who will not take himself out of the lineup no matter what, seemingly. Like, he basically has to be walking on one leg to take himself out of the lineup. He's had very nitpicky injuries that he's played through. But this story was interesting to me, not necessarily because it talked about Freeman's mentality and how he kind of goes about it, but really how all the other players react to Freeman's mentality with this. Austin Riley had a quote in the story where he said, "Freddie, he's the captain of the team, and if you're not playing that day, you better be extremely hurt. It's just the way he's wired. He expects us to play every day, and we're going to," says Riley. And I'd recommend you guys reading the full story. We'll link all these stories in the show notes for today's episode, so you guys can check out all of these articles that we've talked about to kind of further contextualize it. But I think it's a good thing that Freeman himself has this mentality of wanting to play all the time, every day, play through very minor issues that he's dealing with, because it is a long season and you probably want your players to have that mentality. But I feel like someone should be around who kind of stops this from like going too overboard, because it does seem like, and I'll have to look into the numbers, but it does seem like there have been players with the Braves who've kind of worn down as the regular season has gone on. I know there a number of Braves players that were near the top of the league in terms of just games played, Dansby Swanson being one. Ozzy was a guy who's been ridden really hard in the past. Austin Riley is obviously doing the same thing this year. But what is your thinking on a player who has this sort of mentality, and how do you, what do you think is the best way to kind of police that and prevent a player from causing harm to himself or maybe even other teammates?
I think it's, I didn't read the story itself, so I'll speak without full context here, but yeah, I think
don't
it's
even
fine.
Have to talk about this situation specifically, well, just kind of the general mentality and how teams should embrace that or protect players from themselves maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fine that a player wants to play every day and takes pride in doing that. And if, you know, a player like Freddie Freeman, who's, you know, an MVP type guy and, you know, consistent, what, 3 to 5 win type player every year. Like, yeah, I want him, if he can play every day, I want him playing every day. Maybe you want to get him a little bit more rest down the stretch at times to make sure he's fully ready to go in October. But the alternative between having him play and somebody else is going to be a pretty significant gap and a drop off there. But yeah, I mean, there's, you know, it's fine to take days off. It's good to take days off. You want to make sure guys are rested and not playing, not just fatigued, but playing through injuries. I mean, like, yeah, like little minor stuff here and there. Okay. Sometimes you got to play through it, but you don't want to have a guy playing through something where he ends up getting really badly hurt and knocks him out of the lineup for 6 weeks or 2 or 3 months. Because I mean, ultimately, like that's just worse for the team overall. So yeah, as an organization, whether it's your manager or your manager in conjunction with your front office, needs to take a bigger picture view of the most important goals for the team, not just for the player to have the ability to say, yeah, I played 162 or 160 games this season as a point of personal pride.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Freeman is a guy who has played 162 games in 2 seasons, in 2014 and 2018. He played 158 in 2016 and 2019, 157 in 2011. This year, he's leading the league with 146 games played, assuming there's some other players that have also played that many games. But it's interesting with Freeman too, because he doesn't seem like a player who is really affected by that in terms of fatigue. If you look at his month-by-month career splits, he's pretty consistent every single month. It ranges from an 854. I shouldn't say it ranges. May is his worst month, just looking at his career month-by-month splits at 854 OPS, Ben, just for you. And then outside of that, the range is 893 to 908, and it's pretty clustered right in the middle of that for all of his other months. So there's no obvious statistical reason or any statistical evidence just looking at the surface here that shows that he wears down. But I could definitely see a player who just thrives on playing all the time and is very durable and really isn't bothered by things, even if he's not at 100%. I feel like that could still rub off poorly for players who maybe aren't wired or geared the same way, who feel like they kind of have to live up to that same mentality. And with Freeman being the player that he is, and obviously the clubhouse leader, and really the face of the franchise for the Braves, I mean, players are going to follow his example. So it is interesting to think about. Like you said, I think it's good that players themselves want to get on the field every day, no matter what. I do think it's important that teams kind of hold them back from themselves at times and kind of look at the bigger picture, because it's a long season. And for teams that are competing, and really for every team, you want to have your players healthy once you're at the finish line and playing your most important games. There's no point in burning out to get to September if you're not going to be able to play in October.
Yeah. And every player is different. I mean, if Freddie Freeman is able to play every day of the season and not drop off at all, then yeah, go ahead and play every day. I don't have an issue with that, but not every player, like you said, is wired the same way.
Yeah, so those are a few of the newsy items that came up that I felt like were interesting to talk through. We're going to go to a quick break here, and then we'll get into a bunch of listener questions. We have a bunch from last week that we saved, just knowing that this was going to be a little bit of a shorter podcast with some travel obligations and some other things we had to take care of. But thank you guys who have stuck with us to this point. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And we're back. Thank you guys for sticking with us. We're going to, like I said, jump into a few questions that you guys had, make this a little bit of a mailbag heavy episode. And as always, if you guys have any questions you want to throw to us, you can on Twitter at Future Pro Pod. You can at Carlos A. Collazo or at Ben Badler on Twitter. And then you can also follow Ben's Instagram at Ben.Badler. Before most episodes, we'll have a call for questions, but you can send them at any point. Our first one comes from AZ Baseball Fan on Twitter. Does the Dominican Winter League draft order hold any significance in terms of prospect rankings, or is it more to do with the team's positional needs?
I think it correlates somewhat, right, with prospect rankings, at least on the position player side, right? Like you see Orelvis Martinez or Marco Luciano, Noelvi Marte. These guys are the first picks in the draft. So basically every September, the Dominican League can draft players who have reached the full season level. So usually guys who were in low A or high A, or it could be higher too, if they just haven't been drafted previously by a team. So you see these young players from the Dominican Republic get drafted there. So there is some correlation, but these teams are also, they're not playing to have good prospects. They're playing to win. So if, you know, look, there are times where you get a player like a Fernando Tatis Jr. who plays in the league as a prospect and helps lead your team to a championship. But at the same time, you know that those guys probably are not going to carry or get a ton of playing time for you over the course of their career. So it's not entirely about prospect rankings, but it obviously does have some correlation on the position player side. On the pitching side, not quite as much, just because the teams in the league know that the major league clubs are probably not going to allow their pitching prospects to pitch in the league much for the most part. So that's why you see the pitchers go way later. Even if they're, you know, a top 100 pitching prospect in the game, they might still just end up going in the later rounds of the draft there.
Yep. Thank you for that question. We got a couple that are related to Mark Appel. Kayla on Instagram asks, will Forrest Whitley end up being Mark Appel 2.0? And then we had a second question from Joffrey Thoe on Instagram, who asks, will Mark Appel make it back to the big leagues? So Mark Appel is on the mind for a number of people, probably because of a Twitter thread he had that went viral, where he kind of just talked about his experience in the game, why he needed to step away. Definitely an interesting kind of insight into what's going on in his head, how he's dealt with being labeled one of the biggest busts in MLB history, which I can't imagine is easy for anyone to deal with. And it seems like Mark has handled it as well as you could hope mentally. Mark Appel this year has pitched in double and triple A. He's posted a combined 6.13 ERA. He's thrown 69 innings. He's walked almost as many batters as he's struck out. But this is his first time pitching in affiliated ball since 2017. When he was in rookie ball in AAA. But yeah, Ben, I'll just throw it to you. I mean, thoughts on either of these? Will Mark Appel make it back to the big leagues? And what do you think of the comparison of Forrest Whitley and Mark Appel?
Well, I guess, well, you know, will Mark Appel make it to the big leagues? would be the better question, but it's hard to say. I mean, he was out of the game for 2 years, so or actually longer than that.
Yeah, counting the COVID year makes it a little tricky.
So there's that. You know, don't really see much right now from him to indicate that he's going to have, you know, any type of sustained career at the big league level. But if there's some point where he's throwing decently enough for a club that's not in contention, I could see a scenario where he gets called up and they just promote him to the big leagues to, you know, just say, hey, we respect the work that you've done, and we just want to give you that shot in the big league. So that's a scenario where I could see happening. But right now, it's not looking like there's going to be a lot of, there's not a lot to see either in the stuff or performance right now to suggest, any type of sustained big league role going forward.
And then with the Forrest Whitley comparison to Mark Appel, I guess it's kind of a tough one, but two pitching prospects that at their peak were very hyped. I think at one point we had Forrest Whitley as the top pitching prospect in baseball. Is that accurate? And now he's nowhere close to that. Injured right now, hasn't pitched since 2019. I mean, where does Forrest Whitley stand in terms of maybe not even prospect status, but just where is Forrest Whitley in kind of the conversation of failed pitching prospects? I mean, he is still only 23 at this point, I think. He just turned 24 a few days ago. So it's still too early for me to write him off entirely, but I feel like there are probably some people who've already done so. Where do you stand with Forrest Whitley at this point?
Yeah, very different path than Mark Appel. Like you said, he just turned 24. I don't know. I'm not optimistic. I think, but it's hard to say because who knows? I mean, only really the Astros saw him pitch in 2020 at the alternate site. And then sounds like he got shut down, coming back from surgery. I don't know, man. It's I'm not too optimistic about it just because look, like the last time he was really, really good was what? I mean, it wasn't even 2019.
I've got his BRIF page up right now.
I mean, it was like 2017, mm-hmm. right? Was the last time
2017 was the last time really the only season he's thrown extended innings. I guess he did throw almost 60 innings in 2019, but in 2017 he pitched in the Midwest League, the Carolina League, and then he also pitched in the Texas League. So he got up to Double A, and across all three he posted a 2.83 ERA over 92.1 innings, and he struck out 13.9 while walking 3.3 per nine. So pretty good numbers across the board. I mean, his Triple A numbers were even better than his A-ball numbers. So that's probably the last year you point to. I mean, that's I would imagine that's when his kind of prospect hype was at its peak. I'm just pulling up his Baseball America player page right now to see where he ranked the highest for us or what year that was. I would guess it was after the 2017 season.
Yeah. So, I mean, really hard to go off. Go ahead.
For our top 100 rankings, he ranked as the number 31 prospect in 2015. So I guess that's probably the last time it would be.
Yeah. I mean, I think we just overranked him for a few years mm-hmm. after that. I mean, really the last time he pitched like a guy who we were like, oh wow, this really looks like a front of the rotation, maybe number one type starter was 2017. So we're talking 18, 19, 20, 20, I mean, what, four full seasons going into 2022. Obviously 2020 was a difficult, year to gauge, but, I don't know. I'm not optimistic at this point. I think he still could get, to the big leagues. I'm not writing him off, but,
and really quickly, the 2015 was Mark Appel I was like, that the number doesn't make sense. For Forrest Whitley, he was ranked 5 in 2019. So that would have been prior to the 2019 season. He was the number 5 prospect in baseball for us. So apologies for that. That makes more sense of the timeline.
So yeah, I feel like, again, like I think it's you're going off of much deeper history to still be on really optimistic about mm-hmm. him at this point.
That leads into another question that we had that is pretty, or at least related to this. I think there was a question about famous prospects, and here we go. Helmet Cormalis on Twitter asks, pop-up prospect versus pedigree, what's your stance? Example, Samad Taylor versus Austin Hendrick, the first unheralded success, the latter a first round disappointment. So I think just this question of pop-up prospect versus pedigree and how we handle those players, I think at least my stance is it shouldn't really matter. You have to go on the information you have now, currently. How do you evaluate the player now? But I do think it is tough to get rid of the history you have on players entirely when it's necessary, when the player is no longer the player that you were kind of projecting 3 years ago. If enough changes have happened that you need to discount that history. And I think it can be difficult to come off of a player as aggressively as maybe you need to when you have a long history of a player who's ranked very highly and has that pedigree. I think of a guy like Mackenzie Gore, like how to handle that. He was one of the top prospects in his draft class. He was a top pitcher in baseball for us just a few years ago. I mean, entering the season, he was a top 10 prospect. And how to balance adjusting that, when to really, I don't want to say give up on the pedigree, but when does the new information outweigh kind of the pedigree that he had built up previously? I feel like balancing that is extremely tricky. And so some guys who don't have that pedigree can certainly go under the radar a little bit longer, kind of finding that balance and figuring out how to avoid our biases here, or to be like kind of drive through them and figure out the truth with these prospects is very difficult. But what are your thoughts on that, Ben?
Yeah, I guess it depends what you mean by pedigree versus history. Like this guy was a first round pick in 2019. Well, I don't really care about mm-hmm. that at all. But if we're talking about a larger sample size of what he has done over the last few years, yeah, I mean, you weigh that, you weigh the most recent information probably, or certainly the heaviest, but it depends on sample sizes. It depends on different factors. So it's a sliding scale for players. But I mean, Austin Hendrick, I tend to weigh what he's both what he's done in pro ball and as an amateur. I mean, as in both instances, you can see a ton of bat speed and huge raw power. But even again, using that, not so much pedigree, but using the history of seeing him in high school and thinking at the time, yeah, he has a ton of bat speed and a ton of raw power, but he also takes some bad swings sometimes, some pitch recognition issues. I don't know if that's going to lead to some swing and miss, or a lot of swing and miss was my concern on him coming out of high school, especially as an older high school guy. And that's come into play. And
yeah, this year he's striking out in a ball. He's striking out at a 37, I guess at this point he struck out at a 37.6% rate. He did walk close to 20% of the time and had a 380 on base percentage, despite a 211 average. So there is some on base skill there in addition to the bat speed and raw power that you're talking about. But yeah, definitely some strikeout questions that he had as an amateur that have only lingered and maybe expanded in pro ball.
Yeah. So you don't want to just throw out history, but as far as if pedigree is something, as far as either where a guy was drafted a couple of years ago or how much his signing bonus was either in the draft or especially internationally, that it just doesn't have all that much meaning to me.
All right, Rob Dale on Twitter says, for fun, following up on your AAA scout discussions in a previous podcast, what will scouting overall look like in 10 years? Will more high schools be live streaming stat casts? Will AI do most of the draft analysis? Ben, I'll just throw it to you. What's scouting going to look like in 10 years? Pull out your crystal ball. Let us know what's going to happen. Should all the scouts jump into a different field or start prepping their resumes? Are the robots going to take over?
I think you'll see a lot more video in places that aren't currently set up for them now. I think you'll see some more centralized video internationally at big events, especially as MLB tries to push toward an international draft. So it's not like, oh, hey, this team scouted this guy aggressively early on and reached a deal with him at 14 years old. That's not going to happen during an international draft. So you're going to have probably more video, more centralized video that teams are going to have at MLB showcases and things like that. But I think it'll still be like, there's no reason to maybe scouting, you know, evolves or in some capacity where, you know, teams have fewer scouts on the ground in some ways, but I think teams are still going to want, there's certainly, I would still want to have a lot of scouts on the ground identifying these players and especially seeing players where, and getting looks that, you know, these centralized video looks are not going to be possible.
Yeah, I'm curious how scouting departments will just shake out in terms of how various scouts will be siloed from other areas. Like right now, it's pretty normal to have pro scouts, have amateur scouts, have international scouts. I feel like there are some teams that are already moving in a direction where you kind of just have scouts and everyone has a number of different assignments depending on the needs throughout the year, where you will be scouting an amateur player, you'll be scouting an international player, you have pro coverage. And like you said, as video becomes more accessible to all these areas, I feel like it is only more likely that you can have all your scouts kind of looking at a number of different levels and player ages that will probably help the scouts just better contextualize that. And I think that's a pretty common goal for scouting departments as it is for all their scouts to have good context for what are we looking for at the major league level, and kind of just up and down the spectrum of prospects. Like you should be seeing these 16, 17 year olds, I guess even 15 year olds on the international side. You should be seeing these high school players, these college players, and how to kind of fit them all in. And I'm curious to see how scouting departments will kind of develop over the next few years in terms of where teams are going to put their resources and how an international draft might shake up how teams are going to have to just run their staffs out there. That's kind of what I'm curious about. I think, I mean, even in the last 5 years, the amount of data and the specific data points you can use with high school players, with all the TrackMan, the blast motion, just various ways you can measure bat speed, all of the data points and the technology that is really at all of these big travel ball and showcase settings for high schools. Like, I feel like that's only going to continue happening. So there will be a lot of data points for these players. And I think there are probably going to be better options for players to personally use for perhaps like a high school season where maybe you don't have access to a TrackMan system at your high school field, but you're going to have better tools to get some more personal data points to college recruiters and to scouts. I really don't think we're going to a world where AI does most of the draft analysis. At least I hope that's not the case. I don't think that would happen. I just feel like more of these tools that will help you get a more accurate picture of these players will just be more prevalent for everyone and probably at a younger age for all these players. So I don't think anything too extreme will change, but that could just be me failing to imagine things at a wild level. Anything to add on that, Ben?
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is, but I would be curious to see what during like the spring high school season, what might be different in 10 years compared to now, because like you talked about, if you're playing a tournament at Lake Point in Georgia or at the USA facility in Cary, North Carolina during the summer, there's a lot of both video and, you know, different TrackMan data that comes out of that, but you don't really have that same thing happening in the spring. You know, you have like the NHSI, which I hope comes back next year. And
yeah. And even for those events, it's really just a small minority of players. If you're talking about if you're talking about like the draft, it's one thing. If you're talking about players overall, just the entire college landscape, it's an extremely larger group of players. And maybe it's a case where no, every high school field isn't going to have all of this stuff, but maybe different like training facilities, batting cages, driveline equivalents, pitching labs, maybe that is what becomes more common. And kind of everyday high school players who just are trying to get to the next level and play college ball, maybe it's easier for them to hop in a gym somewhere throughout their high school season and get in front of a TrackMan or a Rapsodo machine and kind of continually update your numbers that way. I don't know. I feel like the technology is becoming more accessible. To what extent it becomes like omnipresent in the landscape is what I'll be curious to see over the next 10 years. Because 10 years doesn't seem like a long time, but a lot's going to change in that amount of time. So I guess I'll end it with, I don't really know, but I'm excited to see what happens because I'm sure it'll be interesting regardless. K. Joe Hudson on Twitter asks, should MLB rethink competitive balance picks in the next CBA? There are many teams that closely resemble each other financially that either get an extra early pick and international free agent money each year and those that don't. Not every team that doesn't get an extra pick is the Yankees or Dodgers. I'll just throw it to you first, Ben. What are your thoughts on the competitive balance picks? And should they happen?
Get rid of them. They're competitive imbalance picks. They just imbalance the draft, like you said. I don't see the value in imbalancing the draft to tilt it in favor of some clubs.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think the best thing about the competitive balance picks is that you can trade them. So hopefully we can get rid of the picks, keep the trading of picks and make that just commonplace. And I think that'd be a more fun system. So I tend to agree. I think there's a lot of language that tries to make it seem like these picks are about competitive balance and parity when really it's just poor owners crying poor, probably, and not wanting the rich teams that like to spend and want to spend get away with it more than anything. I'm with you. Ed Casey on Twitter says, I was wondering which players you and Ben would most like to see get Arizona Fall League assignments. Do you have any specific players that come to mind for that, Ben?
I'd like to see Rowanzi Contreras come back with the Pirates. He was looking so good for those first 2 months of the season. Got hurt, came back in September. So I don't know exactly, like, I don't know if he'll play. Did they want to ramp him up and then like shut him down and then like bring him back up again? Or maybe he just keeps pitching. But guys like that who miss some time during the season, I think the Arizona Fall League is a good opportunity for those guys to get more playing time. And then players who were just drafted this year, I'd like to see some aggressive assignments for some of those guys if we can get them to, you know, challenge those guys in the Arizona Fall. Like, hey, like Colton Cowser, I think he's a good player, but in pro ball so far all, you know, we haven't seen him really challenged. Like the Orioles haven't pushed him super hard, you know, not understandably. Most of those guys in college will go to, you know, previously would have gone to the New York Penn League or something. So, but he's only in low A Delmarva. Okay. They don't have an issue with their assignment, but I would like to see, all right, let's see how he does given a, you know, a challenging assignment to the fall, where again, the, you know, the, maybe the pitching is not going to be great for the most part, but I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it'll actually be better, more interesting this year with teams maybe wanting to send some more guys there after we lost the 2020 season, but I'm not sure how that actually is going to look, but those would be the types of guys I'd be excited to see out there.
Yeah. Gabriel Moreno is probably the first guy that came to mind for me. I don't know what his like situation is with his injury, but he did go on a rehab assignment in September, played two games in the FCL. I mean, he was a guy who the reviews we were getting from scouts when he was playing early in the season was just insane. So I'd like to see him. Yeah, I think you're right. Just the guys that missed time. I mean, even Julio Rodriguez who missed some time, not necessarily because of injury, but just because of some Olympic stuff he was doing. I always want to see more of Julio, so maybe that's a cop-out answer. But all the college bats, I think that's a good call. All the recent college drafty bats, maybe even some of the advanced high school players who are able. Like, what if Marcelo Meyer was there? That would be awesome. I don't know what the history is of high school players in the league their first year. But for the guys who performed and you think are really advanced, I would like to see them kind of in the mix with all of these top prospects in baseball on the same field. That would be a lot of fun.
I think probably more likely would be guys, some 2020 high school picks, like a Tyler Soderstrom or Zach.
That's a great, Soderstrom is a great call.
Yeah, Robert Hassel, those guys who've been at the A-ball level, but let's push them to the fall league.
Yeah.
And again, also Soderstrom has been, you know, injured for a lot of the season, but, you know, to have some of those guys really get pushed and see how they do against some upper level arms would be good.
Yeah, like theoretically, I would love to see Jack Leiter too, but I also understand how it probably doesn't make any sense at all to get him heated up and throwing after the workload he just saw at Vanderbilt after going from 15 to like 100. So I think that would be like probably not the best idea, but selfishly, I would love to see it.
Yeah, probably not happening.
Roger Whitehead on Twitter said, "I hear about pitching labs and pitch design. But what is the cutting edge of hitting development look like? Is there any consensus emerging on how to apply science and technology in regards to hitting?" So that's a question from Roger. You have any insight into that, Ben?
What the cutting edge of hitting? What is it?
Yeah, basically he's heard about pitching labs and pitch design, driveline stuff. But what is the cutting edge of hitting development look like? Is there any consensus emerging on how to apply science and technology in regards to hitting development?
Yeah, I think you touched on some of it with just the accessibility teams have now to measure each swing that a hitter takes. Certainly, you know, in a practice setting with different things like the blast sensors or what's the like the K vest, the sleeves that you know players can wear, or just, you know, things like measuring exit velocity or angle off the bat, that type of stuff. And also I think just video too. Like I actually think like the smartphone is underrated, just as far as quick access to video to give players instant feedback on what they just did. I mean, there's, you know, teams will have in their, I don't know if they call them hitting labs. It's, you know, in their batting cages, right? It's a fancy marketing thing that these teams call them labs now. They'll have it. Some of them will have it set up where you can take a swing in the cage, get all of your data that swing produced right away. And then on maybe like a 3 or 4 second delay, it'll show you that swing again. that you just took from the side. So you get instant feedback, because sometimes in your head, what you think you're doing is much different than what you're actually doing. And when you see that video play out in real time or near real time, you have a faster feedback loop to be able to make corrections and make adjustments based on what you just did and what you just saw.
I don't know if this is necessarily cutting edge, because I feel like a few years ago I wrote a story about it with just VR technology and how that could be useful to train hitters. I don't think the technology is to the point where it has seen the returns that maybe people wanted, but I do think it's interesting to think about how VR could help you train as a hitter if the technology gets to the point where it's hard to tell the difference between what you're seeing like in a VR headset or some sort of VR simulation versus like the real thing. Like the ability to get live reps that way and just train yourself to see what that velocity looks like. And even if you're talking about like a more granular like preparation for a specific pitcher, because the technology is there to at least see how the ball looks coming out of a pitcher's hand, how a specific pitcher's pitch mix looks in a VR setting. If the technology there can take a step forward to where basically your whole team, before Max Scherzer is pitching to you, you can get 100 reps of seeing Max Scherzer. I don't know how you can't replicate that in a practice environment. Even if you had a guy who looked just like Scherzer, had the same mechanics, it's not like he's got an infinite amount of throws in him. You're not just going to have someone out there throwing 95 for batting practice. That doesn't seem realistic, but VR as a way to just get reps of real time with pitching and just vision training in general. I feel like any kind of vision training is an area that teams are trying to unlock right now. I don't know, like, what are the limits of how you can improve your vision outside of like contacts and like LASIK and glasses. Like, once basically you've put your eyes in the best situation as far as like just getting the right contacts if you need them, I don't know how much further you can go to train your vision, but I do know that's an area that teams are trying to figure out and see if there is something that can be done to improve that, because obviously that's one of the most important things about hitting, that to this point is kind of like you either have it or you don't. And if that's able to change in the future, I imagine that would be pretty groundbreaking, but I don't have any specifics on like what the status of that is at this point.
Yeah. I think teams have definitely been trying to measure it for a long time. And I think that's important, and trying to figure out ways to improve, prove it, like you were talking about, with probably mixed or not great results. But the VR, I think, mm-hmm. it, like you said, if the technology gets to the point, and it probably is not there yet, but it can rapidly improve in the next, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, maybe, or maybe longer than that, where we know about the times through the order penalty. Well, like you said, what if you can go out and face Max Scherzer, or maybe Max Scherzer is not a great example because he'll still probably strike everybody out.
Maybe he won't. Maybe that's the edge.
But you know, probably for a lot of pitchers, all right, we can go and, like you said, take a whole bunch of reps against a VR version of, I don't know, somebody who's not Max Scherzer, but
Corbin Burns.
Yeah, against the team starting pitcher,
yeah,
for the night. And some of the times to the order penalty, I'm sure, is fatigue from the pitcher's standpoint, but whatever percentage of it is the batter's gaining familiarity with that pitcher on that night, then perhaps, at least there's a hypothesis there, that it could improve, the outcomes earlier in the game for the hitter.
Cream City Prospects on Twitter says, the Brewers have had a few hitting prospects break out this year, and arguably none of them have performed better than Joey Weimer. He's displayed power, speed, and arm strength, albeit over a brief sample. How much has Weimer's performance in 2021 improved his prospect stock? I'll throw it to you first, Ben, but Weimer is fascinating.
Yeah, he's really, he's 6'5", big, strong, athletic, like you said, runs well, power, gigantic arm from the outfield too. And also, at least coming out of college from Cincinnati last year, just had like a big wild ass swing, just lots of moving parts going every different direction. And this year he came out and at least like early on was not great. but as the season's gone on, especially come, you know, August, September, He's been really good. He's simplified his swing. There's still moving parts to it, but it's moving with a lot less unnecessary movement. It's better flow, better sequence to his swing, and you're seeing much better results. Early on in the year, I was not too encouraged, but yeah, definitely what he's done in the second half of the season, and especially after getting promoted to, you know, to high A, mm-hmm. has been really exciting to see from him.
Yeah, we had a Weimer as the number 136 prospect in the 2020 draft, and scouts really liked just the raw tool set, the raw power, the arm strength, the running ability. But there were questions about the noise in the swing that you're talking about. There were a lot of moving parts. He had probably a lower average than scouts wanted to see at 3 years with Cincinnati. He hit just 264, had 12 home runs, had 35 stolen bases. And then, like you're saying, starting off slow and then figured it out, simplified the swing. It seems like getting rid of that leg kick and introducing more of a toe tap has helped him get to the barrel a little bit more consistently. But you look at the splits just month to month. Went from a 640 OPS in May. And see, now you have me saying OPS, Ben. It's really peer pressure. It's all it is. 834 and 834 actually in both June and July. And then August and September really exploded. 1300 and 1100 OPS in those months with 18 of his home runs on the season. So if that mechanical cue is the reason for his success, which I imagine it has to do a significant amount with, you have to be really excited because the tool set has always been loud, and him being able to tap into it more consistently makes him a very exciting prospect. And doing it at a higher classification is exciting as well. Still 22 years old in high A, probably still going to be a little bit skeptical of that hit tool until he can kind of perform against some more advanced pitching, but you have to really like what you've seen from him. And Weimer was one of the 30 prospects that I think Josh put together on the site today of prospects who improved their stock. So for the organization, he was the guy that most jumped out to Josh. So yeah, he's a really good one. Our next question is from Alex Pollock on Twitter. Beyond Adley and Grayson Rodriguez, what are your thoughts on the next tier of top Orioles talent? And they have slowly become one of the better systems in the game. Ben, what are your thoughts on the talent in the Orioles system outside of those top two guys?
Yeah, those guys are obviously carrying it. Adley being number one overall. And
the number one hitting prospect and the number one pitching prospect is a pretty good start.
Yeah, but still a lot of good feedback this year on Gunnar Henderson. We talked about Colton Cowser. DL Hall, I mean, some things you love, some things are frightening between health and strike throwing. But then you see a guy like Shane Baz just tonight, like today, it's like, geez, you can see guys make pretty fast strides sometimes with the strike throwing ability and sometimes in surprising ways. So a lot of upside, but still a lot of, I don't know if I call them red flags or just points of concern with him, but yeah, I mean, Jordan Westberg, I really like the Connor Norby pick for the Orioles in the draft this year. Kobe Mayo, guy who, I mean, thought maybe they'd be a little more aggressive with his assignment, but they kept him in the complex league in Florida early on, hit really well there. They promoted him, keeps hitting really well. So that's a really good sign for him to be, you know, I would say certainly an arrow up guy right now in that system. So obviously, yeah, Adley and Grayson Rodriguez are kind of the anchors of that system, but it's not just because of those two guys that we have them as, you know, one of the top farm systems in the game.
Yeah. And I think the Mayo performance has to be encouraging if you're an Orioles fan, because I mean, he was a big reason, or at least he was, I guess, where the Orioles moved a lot of their pool money in the 2020 draft. I mean, they took Heston Kerstedt at number two. It was not a consensus pick there on talent, but the Orioles have been a team very willing to kind of search for deals where can they save money with their first pick and then spread that money around. Mayo got $1.75 million in the fourth round, and then they also gave $1.5 million to Carter Baumler. And so, I mean, Mayo's production and his performance is going to be key in how we look back and see that draft class. And like Ben was saying, I mean, hitting 319, 426, 555, 9 home runs, 14 doubles is pretty impressive as a 19-year-old. Connor Norby is a bat that I feel like everyone on our staff wound up really liking after his season with East Carolina. He had a solid pro debut, good on base skills. And then Kowser has been one of the better performing 2021 draftees on top of being just one of the better pure hitters in the class overall, and was another guy who maybe a little bit higher than the industry had him at the time in terms of where he went and the pool money that he got for the Orioles, but has looked pretty good so far. So I do like some of the bats. Yeah, and I think there's some interesting players here, but it really does start with Adley Rutschman and Grayson Rodriguez, and that carries a lot of the weight in where we kind of view their org overall. So you can't overlook them entirely, but I guess for some conversation on players beyond the top two, there's some interesting bats for me. Another question from Aaron Strike on Twitter. Cubs prospect Christian Hernandez is ending this season on a tear. What are you looking for him? What are you looking for from a developmental perspective for him this winter and into 2022? Ben, you know this guy better than anyone. So what are your thoughts?
One, just continue to get stronger. I mean, he has a really lean, like projectable frame with a lot of strength projection to it. He already has a lot of bat speed and a lot of raw power, and that's just going to go up as he gets bigger and stronger. As you know, you still want him to retain his athleticism so that ideally he can continue to play shortstop, because I think he has a chance to stick at that position. But I think just getting stronger will help him, and also learning, which I think you're seeing him do more in as that season has, you know, as that season went on for him in the Dominican Summer League, is he has big raw power. But I remember even seeing him as an amateur player, and he would put on a huge show in batting practice with his raw power. And then in games, every time I saw him, and I think a lot of other people too, he always hit well in the games. It's not like he was just a big power guy in BP and then swung and missed a lot. He hit well in the game, but it was more of a, I don't know, like a singles approach, but it was more singles and not as much damage in games. Like, I think he was trying to just put the ball in play in games rather than look to drive the ball with impact sometimes. But that's all right. I mean, the bat to ball skill is there. He clearly has raw power, and that power was showing up more in games and, you know, after that, you know, once they got into August and September. So, just more, yeah, just more maturity and more knowledge as a hitter, which, I mean, kind of sounds obvious to say, I guess, for a 17-year-old kid, but I think he is a smart hitter, but just getting a better understanding of, you know, knowing which pitches to turn on and try to drive with that A swing for impact. I think you'll start to see that, you know, those power numbers go up even more, because I think he is a really talented hitter who has a lot of power and is still just learning how to fully tap into it in games too.
No doubt. And then our final question for this episode comes from Ryan Stevens on Instagram. He asks, who do you think is the best pure hitter in the 2023 class? And again, Ben, this one's going to be directed at you. You've been diving into the 2023 class. We talked about a few of the top position players in the class on our last episode, so I'm guessing maybe one of those is going to be your answer here. But at this point, who's the best hitter in the 2023 class? I kind of assumed this was high school, but I guess if we're doing overall 2023, I'll chime in for an obvious choice on the college side.
All right. Well, I'll give you the high school ones. I probably would go with Max Clark still. Mm-hmm. He is number one overall. Part of that is because he's also, you know, a great athlete who can play center field and play center field really well. Mm-hmm. But just as far as pure hit, bat to ball, use the whole field, he rarely swings and misses. He has a great understanding of the strike zone. It's really uncommon to see him expand the strike zone, and he just sprays line drives all around the field, line to line, and can drive the ball. I think he's another guy where just learning how to, you know, learning which situations to really turn on the ball and drive it with impact, because he does have power too. So mm-hmm. I would probably go with him, although Walker Jenkins, outfielder from North Carolina, committed to North Carolina also, really, really polished advanced hitter, very physical guy, 6'3", strong, drives the ball with impact to all fields. Another guy who really knows the strike zone well and doesn't swing and miss all that much. And then a couple other guys I would throw in there probably would be Kevin McGonigal, a shortstop from Pennsylvania, committed to Auburn. Just as far as performance, this guy rakes like everywhere, man. Although actually at area code underclass, the performance was just okay if you just looked at the box score, but I think every time he just barreled the ball in almost every at bat. So really short swing, good plate coverage, covers, you know, inner third, outer third, short arms, which is good for a nice compact swing for him. And then one other name I'd mention is kind of a, I don't know if I'd call him a sleeper because we have him pretty high up, but Steven Milam, shortstop, committed to LSU. Not a very big guy. He's listed at 5'8", which is probably on the generous side, I think. But, man, he can really hit. He's got a small strike zone, does not expand it much, and switch hitter with a ton of contact in games. He's just probably one of the smartest, highest baseball IQ guys in the class, both at the plate and in the field and just in every facet of the game. But I think he's not that big, but man, he can really hit. He knows the strike zone. I think he's going to be a chance to be a really high, high on base guy. I mean, some similarities to, you know, we talked about Brian Rocchio, some Indians shortstop, not that big of a guy either, a switch hitting shortstop who's in our top 100 and keeps hitting all the way up through double A now. So those are some of the guys I think are some of the best pure hitters in that 23 class from high school. Who are some of the college guys that jump for you?
Yeah, I mean, the obvious guy that I think of in the 2023 class on the college side is Dylan Cruz. I think we've talked about him on the podcast before, maybe just briefly, but he was obviously a very highly touted high school player in the 2020 draft who opted out, got to LSU, and then was one of the most impressive freshmen in college baseball this past spring. Just the hitting ability overall, the on-base ability, and the impact potential. The LSU analytics department does a really good job just putting out some exit velo numbers for their hitters. And the impact that Cruz routinely seemed to drive the ball was really impressive, as a freshman in the SEC. His weighted on base average is one of the best marks of any freshman in the country. He hit 362, 453, 663. So just hitting ability, on base ability, power, kind of all of the above. He has it. I really have loved his swing going back to high school. There were some swing and miss issues that he showed at times, some pitch selection issues at times in high school. But you wouldn't have thought that at all if you watched him this spring. So I think he's really figured everything out. A couple other hitters who are interesting in this class are Jacob Gonzalez at Mississippi and then Enrique Bradfield at Vanderbilt. Gonzalez was a guy who led his team in most major offensive categories last spring, hit 355, 443, 561, walked more often than he struck out. So it does a really good job controlling the zone, hit for impact as well, 12 home runs while playing on the infield as a left-handed hitter. So there's a lot to like with him. And then Enrique Bradfield might be one of the more exciting just players overall in the class. I think if you're just talking about offensive potential in the box, there are probably players, or there are certainly players who are going to bring more power to the table. But in terms of just bat to ball skills, the ability to control the zone and get on base, Bradfield has just a very unique old school skill set. He's a guy who has top of the scale speed that plays on the bases and in center field, where he just makes fantastic defensive plays. And I know I'm kind of getting off of the question, which is best pure hitter, but if you expand the question to the best bat to ball skills, I would think in the college class, Bradfield is a guy who's up there. He just finds a way to put the bat on the ball, uses speed to get on base, doesn't strike out a ton, and just kind of creates chaos for defenses. So he's definitely a player I would try to watch as much as you can. He's one of those guys who's just always doing something on the baseball field that's impactful. So with that little ramble and getting off the point of the question, I think that wraps it up for us on today's episode. We've gone through a number of your questions and we appreciate you guys sending them in. Hopefully we gave you adequate answers. I know Ben did. I'm trying to keep up with him at this point. But thank you guys again. You can send them to us on Twitter. You can send them at Ben's Instagram. And that's going to wrap it up for today. Ben, do you have anything that you want to plug that listeners need to keep up with in the next few days and weeks?
Plugs? No, we got our league top prospect rankings are kind of in the works right now. So hopefully we'll be rolling those out at some point in the near future for you guys. No exact date set yet on when, but I know we've all been making a lot of calls for those lists coming up.
Yeah, I don't have much to plug either. Just thank you guys for listening to the podcast. If you are new and you missed early on when we really plugged to review and rate the podcast, if you haven't done that and feel like you want to, we would love to have you rate and review the podcast. It does still help us out. We're pretty well established in the podcast space, and at least in terms of people know who the podcast is, but we'd always like more people to listen to the podcast and hear it. And that is a way that you guys can help us out with all the various algorithms in the podcasting world. So if you do feel the need to rate and review, we really appreciate that. But I think that's all I have for you. I guess just keep in touch. And until next time, for Ben, I'm Carlos. Thanks for listening, everybody.